languages are today is Mike Silver, and he's a member of the ICANN board, so I'll hand it off to him.
Thanks, Margie. I think really just to give a little bit of background to the session, we're in a situation where Sydney last year, well, certainly a year ago in Mexico City, there was a fair amount of tension. Sydney, a meeting of this size almost came to blows, and I think it was the largest session at the Sydney meeting, second possibly only to the vertical integration session. The fact that we're reasonably well populated but not absolutely full hopefully means that the tensions have simmered and that the various people on the panel and elsewhere in the community have done their work in coming to an appropriate compromise. But let's go through a little bit of the process and where we're at. Firstly, the models that are going to be dealt with today are the culmination of significant work by the ICANN community to identify what we consider to be implementable solutions to address trademark protection concerns. Upon the conclusion of the current public comment process, which is due to close on 1 April 2010, the models will be finalized for inclusion in what will then still be the draft applicant guidebook. Until such time as we move just to the pure applicant guidebook. Just an indication of what we're planning on doing today. We have, a great panel. We've got Mary Wong, in no particular order, Mary Wong, Alan Greenberg, Robin Gross, Zahir Jamil, and Jeff Newman. I'm going to be doing the intro, so you've got about another 2 minutes of me, and then I keep quiet. After that, what we're going to do is we're going to turn it into mini sessions, dealing with each of the STI recommendations. So firstly, we're going to deal with the Trademark Clearinghouse. Zahid is going to lead that session. There's going to be a Q&A within that session. We're then going to close that off after 30 minutes. We're going to move towards the Uniform Rapid Suspension Procedure. Mary's going to be leading that. Then we're going to get on to post-delegation dispute resolution, and Jeff will be leading that. So if you can try to the best of your ability to keep questions to the specific topics, I know that some will be general overarching questions and we'll need to deal with them where they are raised, but generally we'd prefer to deal with topic-specific questions wherever possible so we can get to the real nitty-gritty of the particular issues. There's a timeline slide over there which gives you some indication of the work that people have put in. And again, I just want to pay tribute to everybody who's put in very significant amounts of work around this process. The IRT, who put in an enormous amount of work, whether it was appreciated by everybody or not, is besides the point. They certainly put in the hours and the effort to deliver a very significant document, which was a very useful start towards some additional thinking. We've been through a number of iterations. We've been through a number of procedures. Where we're at the moment, really, is that after the consultation, there was definitely a need to modify some of the IRT recommendations. The board sought the GNSO input on an expedited basis on some of the trademark solutions. The GNSO convened a drafting team called the Special Trademark Issues Drafting Team. Yes, there have been numerous humorous remarks made about the particular abbreviation that would transpire from that name. They have arrived at a set of conclusions. Those were unanimously approved by the GNSO. The revised models and explanatory memorandum have been posted, and we now have public comments running until the end of March and will close on 1 April. So if you have significant concerns still and you feel that they haven't been addressed, this is the time to do it now. So it gives us if you want to look at it, a complete set of trademark protections or right protections mechanisms specifically focused to trademarks, but not exclusively, where you have the trademark clearinghouse, you have the uniform rapid suspension procedure, you have the post-delegation dispute resolution mechanism, if it's adopted, and Jeff will deal with that in more detail. You have requirements around a thick who is, and you have the ability to rely on the standard UDRP. Now, that's notwithstanding the fact that the GNSO is currently going through a PDP around rights protection mechanisms. That is likely, given the nature of PDPs, to take a relatively significant amount of time. So this will be a topic that, once it's completed, and assuming that there are no significant issues raised within the public comment forum or within the public comment period, can be signed off by the board and go into the draft applicant guidebook, which means we've completed this phase. Once the PDP is complete, and to the extent that the PDP differs, the contractual provisions would then allow for the results of the PDP to supervene the results coming through this process. So this is to some extent an interim process, but it is likely, given the nature of PDPs, to be around for some time. So that introduction having been provided, I think let's get on to our first critical issue, which is the question of the trademark clearinghouse and dealing with some of the key features. Again, as I said, we'll take approximately 30 minutes for a brief overview and then hopefully some interaction with the audience in terms of concerns, questions, or comments that people may want to make.
Hi there. So hi, Jamil. I'm a GNSR counselor from the BC, but I'm here in my personal capacity. The STI basically, first, I'll just sort of, if you could have a minute to talk about the work done here. I think this is an excellent example of how cross-constituent, cross-stakeholder group actually really worked well together. And in that, basically came to a large degree of consensus. And a lot of common ground was reached, especially between non-commercial and commercials and even the contracted party house. However, it is important to note that the STI was formed to only look at two areas. One was the trademark clearinghouse, and the second was the uniform rapid suspension and nothing else. Moving to the trademark clearinghouse, the key features. I'd like to just say it's not on the slide at the moment. Are we moving to the next one? The slides. Right, thank you. I've got different slides here. So it's not mentioned on the slide, but the STI recommended this not as a rights protection mechanism, but merely as a tool. So it's a pre-launch, not a post-launch, but a pre-launch tool. That was the recommendation of the STI. It's a centralized database. That's basically what it is. It's a storage of trademark registration and data. So trademark registration data would come in here and would be housed in this. The data would be authenticated by a third-party provider who would take the different applications of registration and authenticate them. It does not create any new rights or limit any rights. And it does not, this is an important distinction also, does not, any failure to be in this clearinghouse, as the STI said, does not prejudice your rights either. So it's voluntary to be in there. The types of trademark data, trademark registrations of national effect. Those are the things that go in, number one. Number two, the STI recommended that court-validated common law trademarks should be included. So basically, unregistered trademarks, famous names, if you had any sort of company names, et cetera, they wouldn't be part of this, at least as a mandatory requirement. Required use by new GTLD registries. So it's a mandatory requirement that you have at least two different procedures for pre-launch. One, a sunrise service, or a trademark claim service, which is that they will send you out and let you know that, you know, somebody's trying to register this trademark that you've registered previously, and you can then subsequent or after the launch think about if you want to launch a challenge. Costs to be borne by parties benefiting from the trademark clearinghouse. Many people discuss who would pay for this. And eventually, the language of the STI recommendation is the costs are to be borne by the parties benefiting from the trademark clearinghouse, and that's it. It hasn't specified exactly who that may be. Moving to the next slide. The trademark clearinghouse's key features are that, in continuation, model adopts substantially all of the GNSO STI recommendations with a few exceptions, and I'll let others also talk about them. One of the exceptions are that the STI had suggested and recommended that only those registrations go in from trademark registrars where substantive review has taken place of those applications. So if somebody's applying, it would be a question of whether the application is based on a trademark registration by a trademark registry in a certain country, and whether that country actually does a substantive quote-unquote review. We're not really clear, and I'm going to move on to other issues from there. So the registry is required to provide either Sunrise or TM claim service for these particular marks. The registry may also request additional validation of use, but that's a may, it's not a mandatory requirement. The TMC is also allowed to have additional solutions built into this. So the trademark holders may opt out of an ancillary service. Now, this is basically generalizing what the SDR recommendations of the Trademark Clearinghouse are. Speaking as a person who has represented business, et cetera, in the past, and especially on the SDI, it would be sort of important for me to also take a few minutes, a couple of minutes maybe, to discuss what the minority reports, at least from the business constituency, were. Those slides are not up here. It's something I'd just like to sort of speak about, and that's what I've been told the way to do it. Most of the comments, and you see the summary by the staff also, a lot of the business people have said, and that's what the BC also said, was, well, we are not going to completely object to this. We will put in a minority report. But that is because there's something is better than nothing. That was basically the message that the business constituency sent forward. We also had an issue with the pre-launch Sunrise Clearinghouse just being pre-launch, and the only issue being that it's Sunrise. It doesn't have many other sort of remedies attached to it. We also had some reservation with regard to the definition of identical match. One of the views was that .Asia has had a broader match and a successful launch. Why should that not be seen as a bare minimum? And it's been done before, and maybe that should be the bare minimum to protect trademark owners. So what the .dot Asia model was, mark plus words in the NIST classification, and .dot EU's recognition of common law trademarks. The limitation on the use of mandatory for the TMC data by contracting parties that only requires Sunrise periods or pre-launch TM claims, which means that all the remedies that the Trademark Clearinghouse provides are pre-launch. The moment the new GTLD is launched, the Trademark Clearinghouse provides no remedies per se. That was at least our understanding of it. And so we sort of questioned the sort of value that this investment would necessarily bring, because it leaves open the issue of defensive registrations after the launch of a TLD and the burden that defensive registration put on businesses and people who register. So these are basically some of the issues that the BC had. I'm sure through a lot of questions answering this 30-minute session, we'll be able to talk more about it. But basically, we have also sort of, as I'm saying, something is better than nothing, moved ahead with it. But it's important to note that not just us, the entire SCI believes that the Trademark Clearinghouse is not a rights protection mechanism for trademark. It is just a tool. That's exactly what the SDI says. So I just wanted to stress that point, and thank you for the time.
Thank you. I think that should be pretty clear, but it might be worthwhile, again, because there may be some in the audience who are not trademark lawyers like myself. So we may want to actually drill down a little bit into some of these issues, and in particular this question of substantive review and the question if the trademark is registered in a country which doesn't exercise some form of substantive review. What is the consequence and what is the meaning? But, Robin, I don't know if you want to possibly come in on this and give a reaction.
Thank you. Yes, overall, I think the staff did a really good job with the report that came out and following to most of the way the STI group's recommendations. And then this issue of including trademarks that have not been substantively reviewed is a change, is one deviation that we see as being a real problem from what the STI group agreed to. And one of the reasons for that is if you allow the trademarks in that don't come from countries with substantive review, it's pretty much just a pay your fee, get your trademark, you're entitled to the new GTLD done. So it's too easy. We need to make sure that the trademarks that get in there actually are vetted, actually are not generic words, are not something that shouldn't be an entitlement to only one individual or organization. So that's really the only problem, or the biggest problem, that we have with the what has come out with the Trademark Clearinghouse, is that change, is allowing these substantive, non-substantive review country trademarks in. So that's, we see that as being a problem. It's just too broad. It's going to allow for generic words to be essentially trademarked and entitled to new GTLDs when, in fact, trademark law wouldn't allow for that. So it's broadening the scope of rights too far and deviates from what the STI group came up with. Although, I think overall the report that came out did a very good job overall of trying to maintain compliance with what the STI group came up with. So that's the only really big problem that we have with the Trademark Clearinghouse. I don't know if anyone else has any comments on that.
Alan, I know you wanted to come in there, but just one thing I wanted to clarify. When we were talking about ancillary services and this question about whether or not trademark holders, once they're in the clearinghouse, whether ancillary services can be provided and whether it's an opt-in or an opt-out or exactly how that works, I'm assuming that that would then be to provide some sort of trademark or domain watch service so that the clearinghouse could then have a life beyond the launch of the new GTLD, but it would be an option that a trademark holder could elect to proceed with or not.
I'll prefix my comments saying at large has not had any real discussion of the new staff proposals, but I have had a number of informal discussions, and I feel comfortable that most of what I'm going to say will be supported by others. At large, pretty strongly supported the STI proposals. We did submit a minority report, which perhaps curiously enough was very much in line with the business community report, although not going quite as far as they would suggest. The one concern we've seen in the staff proposal is the same one that Robin suggested, that is the use of trademarks that have not received substantive review, that is the requiring registries to use them. Our concern is not a philosophical one, though. It's a very practical implementation one. The proposal calls for either objections to address the problem where generic words have been registered, or that the Trademark Clearinghouse do the kind of substantive review that a UDRP panel might do. And we find that that kind of process, I think, is going to be quite unwieldy and probably impractical to do. So we question whether it's implementable as opposed to whether it's philosophically a good way to follow.
The chair recognizes the chair.
Does the audio-visual team recognize the chair? No? Is now a good time to ask a question, or do you want to leave them till later on?
Because I'd like absolutely, to let's engage.
Thank you. I'd like to pick up on the point that Robin and Alan have just raised, because the board got hung up on this and reviewing this ourselves. We all, just to confirm, we've spotted this, and we too are concerned. Can you just explain, so that we've got exactly clear how the proposal is going to work? As we understand it, it's going to allow registrations that have not been substantively examined, but is going to put the onus on the clearinghouse to do some kind of validation process itself. And if that's the case, we are concerned about that, because here we've got, here we are apparently competing with national registration systems to check validity. The clearinghouse managers don't have the resources, don't have the training. Why are we doing this? What we tend to do at ICANN is go to other people's tests and standards and say, you've checked it, we'll rely on it. We use the list of country codes that the UN uses. We haven't tried to invent our own list of country codes. So why are we requiring our clearinghouse to start becoming a trademark registry office?
Mary, do you want to take that?
Peter, I'm going to take a stab at that. And I'm doing this as someone who's reading the staff proposal, so maybe staff can clarify if I'm reading it wrongly. And this goes back to Mike's earlier comment about ancillary services. Because when I read the February 15th document, I read it to say that the data in the clearinghouse would only be what Zahid said, that is, registered trademarks or court-validated unregistered marks. And I'm not using the phraseology common law marks because I think it's a lot easier if we simply recognize that they're unregistered marks, meaning that they're not registered in any national, regional, international trademark office. So those are the only two types of marks that go into the clearinghouse, in which case the basic service, sunrise, or trademark claims would then pertain to those marks, the registered and the court-validated. Then when you go to the later part of the staff proposal where it says under sunrise and trademark claims that the clearinghouse should provide the following services, I read it as a choice that either your services are limited only to the marks that you have, i.e. the registered and the court-validated, or as an ancillary service, as an arrangement, a voluntary arrangement between the clearinghouse and a particular registry. As an ancillary service, they can offer those services for the other kinds of marks that they are not required to collect. I'm not sure if I'm making myself clear, but that was my understanding of the document.
Well, I think it's certainly a useful expose, and I think that, as Peter pointed out, it was an item that caused some discussion at the board yesterday, but I think we would certainly welcome community input on that specific issue and to see if people have some issues. I think it's worthwhile going to some of the comments. I'm going to ignore the first because it's a very general one which we can possibly turn to a little bit later. But sorry, Amy, please.
Thank you. I think there's just a little clarification on what Mary said. As my understanding is that the proposal is that all federally registered marks and court-validated marks get into the clearinghouse. And please correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, that the STI proposal was that the registries would only be required to provide the services to those that were from countries that provided a substantive review. So there's more data in the clearinghouse than what the registries would be required to provide services to. The revised proposal indicates that there's a choice, that the registries could choose to provide services to all of the federally registered and court-validated marks, or, and this is the new issue, that they could also choose to only provide services to the ones where there was substantive review upon registration, and if the clearinghouse validated the marks that were in the clearinghouse in some subsequent fashion, then those would then be also deemed substantive review, and they would get a check mark or some kind of mark in the clearinghouse, and they would then be all the substantive reviewed ones that are in the clearinghouse that would that the registries would be required to provide services for.
Thanks, Amy. There's a question raised, and I think just to clarify, I thought that Zahid had clarified it more than adequately already. The Trademark Clearinghouse is used for secondary registrations. The process of applying for a new GTLD goes through a very different trademark verification process in the independent review. So this is, once an application has been granted, this is a rights protection mechanism of a form. I know that you don't necessarily agree that it's a rights protection mechanism, but it's a mechanism which takes place once you start opening up a new GTLD for secondary registrations. One of the comments that's been raised is, well, you know, if this works so well and efficiently, theoretically you could, as a trademark holder, cancel your entry in the rights clearinghouse once there's been, once that new GTLD is opened up for registrations. I think that is, in theory, correct, but in practice, absolutely incorrect, because the intent going forward is not to have a stop-start new GTLD process, but rather once we get the machine going, the machine should start spitting out new GTLDs on a continuous and stable basis for so long as it doesn't cause whiffs of smoke to start appearing at the edges of the DNS, as I think the phrase was very eloquently used earlier this morning. So there's not going to be a stop. It's going to be a launch of one new TLD and followed by another or another four or five, and the following day or week, another. So in theory, yes, but in practice, not quite. Any further questions from the floor?
There's a question from remote. Nick Wood asks, has there ever been a definition of substantive examination in the discussions of the STI?
It seems that there wasn't a clear definition for various reasons. And, Kathy Kleinman has made the suggestion that the definition to be used is the one deriving from the IRT definition. But I think that that's something we should possibly not conjecture about here.
We did do a lot of discussion on the issue, and it was clear that there are in some jurisdictions which do no review whatsoever. That is, you pay your money, you give the mark, and you get it. There are others which do not, which do some level of review, but do not do the same level of review that some, let's say, the United States does. I do not believe we defined where the threshold was in what we called substantive review, though.
And just to follow up on that briefly, my personal opinion, and since we're talking about a clearinghouse that simply does a match, and I do have some comments on the identical match that I'll leave for the moment, that as the clearinghouse, I'd be concerned about a couple of things. I would be concerned about having to validate, and I'm using the language in the recommendations, a unregistered trademark, which in those jurisdictions that recognize these as common law trademarks depends on territorial restrictions and evidence of use. So I'd be a bit concerned about that. I would be much more comfortable if I simply had to authenticate or validate whatever you want to use and list and match registered trademarks. As a matter of principle, I think it's really hard to distinguish between marks with substantive review and marks without substantive review. So as the clearinghouse, if you simply had a list of registered marks and that was what you had to match, that seems to be the most minimal and safest way to go.
Other questions from the floor specifically on the trademark clearinghouse?
Yes, thanks. Well, Wendy Seltzer, as another participant in the STI, I just wanted to add to the discussion that a concern the STI considered deeply was how can we limit the discretion of the clearinghouse and not put ICANN or an ICANN contractor in the role of determining what is a trademark, what is a valid trademark. There are national bodies established to do that under national laws, and we don't want to duplicate that effort if we're going to mandate that the registries listen to and use this clearinghouse. We want it to be a clearly defined set of marks in that clearinghouse. And so keeping it to the validated and registered marks or court-validated marks was a way to define a set that didn't leave ambiguities and didn't leave a great deal of discretion, which was of concern to lots of different people in the community for lots of different reasons.
Thank you. Yes?
Thank you, Bart Lieben. I'm a partner with Laga. In the past 5 years, I've managed directed Sunrise processes for .eu, .mobi, .asia. .tel.me.
Sorry, if you wouldn't mind just dropping the mic slightly so that you're speaking more directly.
I'm sorry. So in the past 5 years, I've directed a couple of Sunrise processes for instance, .eu, .asia, .tel, quite recently. About 450,000 intellectual property claims were dealt in those processes. In that sense, when I'm looking at the substantive review, I think we need to make a clear distinction between the actual concern is not having a domain name registration on a trademark for a generic word, what is said, what I'm referring to as a dictionary word, because if you look in practice, it's perfectly possible to have a trademark for a generic word. Take Apple, for instance. Yeah? Apple is a protected trademark. I don't think that there's any argument against that. Nike is a protected trademark. It means victory in Greek. So why should that be included or excluded? So I think we clearly need to make a distinction there between, on the one hand, substantive review, which at a certain point ICANN would make a determination on what is a good trademark system or a bad trademark system. And I think that is a very big risk that is not for ICANN to determine. I think if you look at the safeguards that have been implemented, for instance, for .asia, and that we're now also doing for .co within a couple of weeks with the launch process there, is that if somebody would apply for a domain name on the basis of a trademark that corresponds with a dictionary word, which the community refers to as a generic trademark, at that point in time, we will be asking the trademark owner to provide evidence that he's actually using the trademark in a trademark sense. And if you look at the .eu experience, where there was a bit of a possibility to game the system, if you want, or at least some members of the community felt like that there was the possibility of gaming the system, you had a lot of, or there exist a lot of trademarks that are for generic words or dictionary words. So this is a good way, I think. This has worked in the past. We've done this in the past. 30,000 claims in .asia, not a single dispute on that. I think this is a more easy and comfortable way for the new GTLD process and for ICANN to proceed with. Thank you.
I'm going to read a statement from David Taylor. He states, the question of eligible trademarks is key. We should not exclude many EU countries, nor for that matter community trademarks. Are these included for the URS? I would say that it is wrong to say that CTMs are not subject to substantive review.
Bruce, do you want to come in here, and then we can wrap this up and get a response from the panel?
Well, I guess I wanted to raise a different topic. So did you want to have the panel respond to that question? Or?
No, carry on, okay. Because we need to wrap up on the clearinghouse.
The question I have around the review of the trademarks partly relates to whether you're using a Sunrise process versus an IP claims process, because I think they're very different. I think if you're dealing with an IP claims process, essentially what you're saying is that a person can apply for a name and they are notified if there is any trademarks associated with that name. Now, presumably, that person that's notified makes a judgment based on whether the trademark is, you know, depending on what country it's from and depending on what classification it's in, and whether that person applying for that name feels that they might infringe that trademark. In that context, I think it's pretty clean. I think you are operating a registry of trademarks. I don't think you have to have some external body decide whether they've had review or not. It's just a list of trademarks. You, as an applicant, make your decision based on that information. So I think that's pretty clean. Sunrise is really different, because Sunrise, you're actually giving one entity, a first option over identity that doesn't have a trademark. So basically you're saying, if I have a trademark, I have the first right to apply for a name before anybody else is allowed to apply. So there, perhaps it is more important that you have a higher standard as to how strong should that right be to basically have priority over other applicants. I think those two things need to be very clear, that you have Sunrise, where you're giving a trademark holder priority over people that don't have a trademark, and IP claims, where there is no priority, anybody can apply, they're just simply notified of any trademarks on the names. I just wonder if anyone wants to comment on that distinction, And have the panel thought about whether either Sunrise or IP Claims has benefits, or whether you're fine with leaving those two options on the table?
Thank you for that. I just want to go to Jeff Newman, who had a comment, and then Alan also wants to respond to that question.
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me? I guess you can. My comment is on, from a registry perspective and being on the STI group, our biggest concern was that we did not want to have a registry that basically mirrored every other registry that's out there. In other words, it's not in our interest to have a bunch of defensive registrations in a Sunrise process that really sit there that don't have any use. So to the extent that there are trademarks from a jurisdiction that does not have a substantive review, to the extent they have marks in there like blog and web and auto and all these other generic words, that really does us no good and really are not marks that we want to recognize as a registry, because to us the value of a name being used is far greater than the minimal fee that we may get from a defensive Sunrise registration.
Alan?
In response to Bruce, I'm not quite sure what the final staff February 15th proposal says. The STI report made it very clear that the registry had the right to not use marks from jurisdictions without review for the Sunrise process. It did not give them that discretion for IP claims. So it did differentiate in exactly the way you're suggesting. I'm not sure that was accurately reflected in the staff proposal or not, but presumably it should have been.
And Mike has allowed me a quick follow-up, so I'll try and make it brief. And Bruce made the point that I did want to make as well, and there are, as Alan has just said, important distinctions between the two mechanisms that the clearinghouse can push out to registries. On the IP claims service, you're not prevented from registering, even if there's somebody else with a trademark with that name. In a Sunrise process, the trademark owner gets the priority right to register. And in this context, I just want to say that that's why the test for an identical match, to my mind, in a new process with a clearinghouse that's going to have a lot of different functions to deal with, should be kept as narrow as possible. People in the community have suggested that the different dot X, Y, and Z have used different processes. But each Sunrise process with each registry is also different. So .Asia's is different from .EU's, for example. And most of them start with the identical match, meaning the exact textual match. Things like plurals, for example, things like adding the NIS classification of goods and services is not a universal match test by all existing Sunrises, and to the extent that they're there, it is a very refined and sophisticated process. And so far, the process within ICANN in talking about the clearinghouse has really not gone that far. So the one thing I would add to the distinction is that in a Sunrise process for the identical match test, I would recommend a very narrow test.
Let's, I think, take one last issue on this topic, or one last question on this topic, and then let's move along. The one thing that I wouldn't mind also just getting a response when we close off and after the question is also then whether as the DAG moves towards the AG, whether we should allow the current situation that we have of either a Sunrise or an IP claim process, but that we should actually choose one or the other.
Chair, if you're going to move on to ancillary services.
Okay. No, please continue.
Oh, very good. My name is Ron Andruff. I'm with the business constituency, but I'm speaking in my personal capacity. I just wanted to ask the question of why were ancillary services brought into this mix when, in fact, the clearinghouse had a very specific function, as we understood from the community. So it's a little unclear for some of us in the community why ancillary services is there, and more importantly, what are those services? What would they be?
I made an assumption. I don't know if anybody can help save me from making an ass out of myself by assuming too much. Uh, as I indicated earlier, I think the only reason I can think of for that, and again, I think it's something that that's worth a little bit further investigation, is that if you were to offer some sort of rights watch or IP claims service post-registration, that would be an ancillary service which could be on-sold to people having entered into the clearinghouse initially. I would assume that's where it's coming from, but again, as I say, that's not necessarily a conclusive statement.
It was. I think we haven't defined that on the STI. It is open and just ancillary services. There was a lot of discussion. A lot of people had views. There were several examples. I won't necessarily go into them, the sort of examples that were there, but it's been left open. You could even have some people who actually, I know some registries are launching and considering even having something equivalent to a list, and that could be done through this as ancillary services. But again, the STI didn't actually specify anything in the report per se. And I have points. I mean, are we going to go back? Well, can I just finish my points first? Yeah.
So if I may then, if I understand this correctly, it means that if a provider steps up and says, we'll provide this service, and if they're selected, this is kind of a carrot for them that they might be able to sell on other services. Is that correct understanding?
As long as the trademark holders consent to that.
Thank you.
And of course, the registry consents to that. I think let's wrap up on that because we do need to move on to the URS, but let's wrap up. So the closing remark.
Thank you. So just to clarify something that me and Mike were just discussing, I was reading the STI Trademark Clearinghouse section. Right in the first line it says, and I think this will clarify all for all of us, there is a consensus among the members of the SDI that though this was not a rights protection mechanism, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's very clear that the SDI itself, not, and I just want to make sure that this is not my personal view that's coming out, but this is what the SDI suggested. This is not a rights protection mechanism. And I completely agree with a lot of statements made here that the job of the trademark clearinghouse should be limited and it shouldn't be making a judgment call. Let me just make one small point. If you read the redlined version of the new staff proposal on paragraph 7, which was earlier clarified, it says that the services must recognize, one, all registered trademarks in the trademark clearing database, full stop, and for some reason it doesn't actually mention the court-validated ones in that one. And then in number 2, it says registered and validated. So I think maybe there was some... that needs just to be added, and exactly. Just I think that's what caused the confusion. But I think that clears that the intention was to have court validated in number 1 as well. So just for the audience, that just to clarify those 2 points. Thank you.
Great. Let's wrap up on IP clearinghouse.
One last point on the clearinghouse.
No, I'm sorry. Can we close up on the IP clearinghouse and then move on to the URS? We can take general comments at the end or other specific issues. I did make it clear that I was taking one last question on clearinghouse. So IP clearinghouse, we now understand, is not a rights protection mechanism, but rather it's an automated database against which verification can take place, either for Sunrise registrations or for IP claims. Makes sense. There seems to be consensus. We seem to have a few rough edges which need to be smoothed over, but we seem to have pretty good consensus. Let's see if the next one is as easy to understand and to achieve that level of satisfaction within the community. So, Mary, if you wouldn't mind just giving a brief expose of the URS process, and then we can take some questions and discussion on that one.
Mike, I don't mind at all, though that sounded a little bit like a challenge. So we have a couple of slides on the Uniform Rapid Suspension Mechanism, known as the URS, and we're not proposing to go through them in any great detail because we're assuming that just about everyone in the room either has followed the process or understands the basic concepts and how it's going to work. So there are just a few points I'd like to emphasize. The primary point is that the URS is not the Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy, the UDRP, which is in effect right now through all registrars and registrants. Neither does it replace or displace the UDRP. So it works alongside the UDRP, and some would say it sits on top of it. And it actually serves a very different function. it is meant, and all the reports from the IRT to the STI to the staff proposals make it clear that the URS is meant to address very clear-cut cases of trademark abuse. And as such, even though if you look at the URS, if you look at the document, you might find that the substantive grounds look the same and are the same as a UDRP proceeding, there are some very significant differences because of this particular function, only clear-cut cases of abuse. The two most obvious differences are that the standard of proof in a URS proceeding is different, is higher, where a UDRP uses a preponderance of the evidence, a URS proceeding requires clear and convincing evidence that the registration is in bad faith, that the registrant does not have legitimate rights in the domain name, and so forth. So that's one very big difference. And the second difference, or rather the second major difference that's caused some consternation in the community, is that unlike a UDRP successful complaint, there is no cancellation or transfer of the domain name. It is a suspension system. So in effect, the domain name is still around. It's not transferred to the trademark holder. It remains in a freeze state or suspension. So if I'll just go quickly through these points, I don't propose to read them to you. I just want to highlight a few things. One of the things that the STI report does and that the staff proposals pick up on is that it tries to enumerate and it tries to provide guidance to registrants who may be the subject of a URS complaint as to what the boundaries are, what is and is not a clear-cut case of trademark abuse. So, for example, where if you're an innocent registrant, you are able, even if you miss the deadline for filing a response, which I believe is 20 days, even after that time, you can come back and file a response up to 2 years after that date. At some point, you would probably have to pay a bit of an answer fee, but cost aside, you can always come back during that two-year period and file a response to the complaint. So there are a couple of protections. That's one of them. Except for the late response fee, there's generally no cost to the registrants. And in addition, I've already talked about the remedies, so next slide, please. In addition, other protections for registrants, which the STI called safe harbors and the staff proposal refers to as defenses, there are some examples about what would not be a clear-cut case of trademark abuse. So, for example, a fair non-commercial use of the trademark, a parody or a criticism site, and other types of uses that do not constitute bad faith or illegitimate rights to the name. And I understand that the STI referred to quite a lot of models in coming up with this, including the nominate model, and I'm glad to see that that has stayed in the report, and I do think that these additional protections and clarifications will provide a lot more guidance to the community. And well, it's kind of hard trying to listen to yourself, watch yourself in Adobe Connect, and look at the screen all at the same time.
In terms of the new meaning to multitasking.
I know. In a Web 2.0 world, I guess I'm a slow learner. I've talked about some of these other points already, so I think the last point I want to highlight is that, again, unlike the UDRP, there are prescriptions in the STI report and the staff proposal that deal with abusive complaints. And so, for example, if a rights holder or trademark holder files two abusive complaints, there are penalties. If there is what is termed a deliberate material falsehood in the complaint, penalties should also follow. At this point, I should add, and those of you who have looked at the proposals will know this, that I think some work still needs to be done as to what an abusive complaint is, as to what a deliberate material falsehood is. I know that the IRT struggled with this, and we ended up not making a recommendation. But on this point, I would encourage the community to put in public comments to assist the staff in coming up with guidelines on this. The final point I want to mention, and this actually escaped me the first time I read it. I hope that you are more eagle-eyed readers than I am. Even though I said that the standards in terms of what is required for a URS complaint and what is required for a UDRP proceeding are similar, bad faith and so forth, that is true. But the first requirement And this is the baseline requirement for any kind of trademark or trademark-like rights, that what you're using is an identical mark or a confusingly similar mark. In the UDRP, it is simply that it's identical or confusingly similar to a mark in which the complainant has rights. As many of you know, this has allowed panelists in a lot of proceedings and to have to wrestle with the idea of whether common law and unregistered rights actually fall within that ground, and a number of panel decisions have said yes, unregistered common law rights would count under that first limb of the UDRP. In contrast, the URS, as proposed, is quite a lot narrower, at least in my view. So rather than simply any mark in which the complainant has rights, you can only file a URS complaint if it is a registered mark from a jurisdiction with substantive review. And I suppose that brings us back full circle almost, and on that I'll conclude my remarks and allow for discussion.
Perfect. Questions, comments from the audience? Absolutely. Please.
I've got two comments. One of them, in reading the staff proposal and perhaps the STI also, ICANN still seems to have a fixation that domain names are only used for the web, and there needs to be some cleanup because people do, in fact, use domain names for things other than the web. You know, email might be an example. The other one is there is a very substantive change in the STI and the staff proposal from previous requests, and this applies both to the URS and to the clearinghouse trademark claims process. We have specified that you must talk to people through registrants in a language which they can understand, and that is a very substantive difference. That is, if you're going to send a complaint to someone, you should do it in the language that they registered the domain in. And since there are very tight time constraints, it's only reasonable to do that. One of the examples that was used along the way from one of our members in a French-speaking country is a statement saying, to his neighbor, anything in English is spam. And I think the fact that we've caught these kind of things in a world where we're going into IDN in a big way, I think is important.
Robin, comments, response?
Thank you. One of the non-commercial users worked very hard with the other members of the STI to make sure that there were these safe harbors that were built into the URS. And one of them in particular was a safe harbor for websites that are operated solely in tribute to or in criticism of a business or a person. There's a slight change that was recommended to this, perhaps from the staff proposals, based on a comment from Microsoft that changes what the STI, or perhaps changes what the STI said, to require a finding of fair use before, or adding that onto the criteria, the test of the criteria. So it's what we need here is some clarification. There needs to be a finding of fair use by whom? Presumably we mean the panel, right? The panel says, yes, this is fair use, okay, go on. But it's just not clear in the staff proposal because it says that you can go on as long as there's a finding of fair use, but it doesn't say by whom, and arguably one interpretation of that sentence would mean there has to have been a previous finding of fair use, as in you've got a court ruling or something to prove that you are, in fact, a fair user, and without that, you don't fall under this safe harbor. So I don't think that's what staff intended. This is probably just a clarification error issue where we just need to add into this that the finding of fair use would have to be by the panel and not per se a previous court.
Jeff, I believe you have a question. I'd rather hear from you rather than reading it.
Okay. I thought it might be easier. I guess my question for the panel and maybe for ICANN staff is, now that many of the UDRP providers are providing for their own fast track or cheaper alternative for the, quote, easy cases, has the panel or has ICANN staff considered what to do with that or whether a URS is actually needed?
Amy, I think you're being put on the spot here.
Thank you, Amy Stathis. Jeff, I'd like to know, when you say a lot of them are providing an expedited fast track or cheaper, I know that the Czech Arbitration Court has recently indicated that it is changing its fee structure for matters in which there is no response. That is the only change, as far as I see, from theirs. I don't see that any other UDRP provider has implemented anything else, and I could be wrong, but I don't see that there is any other expedited process from a UDRP provider.
Well, maybe someone from WIPO who's in the audience could talk. I know that there is a proposal going around within WIPO that talks about a new process, but I don't believe they've released it to the public. I certainly haven't seen it, but my understanding was that it provided for cheaper fees, but also a faster moving process as well.
Yeah, I think that's what WIPO has said that they are going to propose. We have not seen it, and it hasn't been proposed as far as I know.
Before WIPO actually introduces it, perhaps they... a review is done by the community to see how the two would interact, as opposed to just having the dispute providers implement a new policy that hasn't been considered by the community.
Jeff, instead of presuming, let's get the answer from WIPO directly.
Thanks, Jeff. Brian from WIPO here. It's true we have been exploring ways to further expedite and make more cost-efficient the UDRP within the existing framework based on the ability to address issues such as word limits and fees in the supplemental rules. And we very much think it's an open question and agree with you there that there are questions regarding the scope of interoperability between any URS and any efficiency gains that can be made within the UDRP process. So for us, that's very much an open question.
Peter, you wanted to come in?
Yes, thanks, Mike. I just wanted to warn the community that there's a real danger of this mechanism actually having been agreed and the board voting on it and us moving on. The silence that that was the response to Mary's outline and the fact that Robin can only find one quibble, which she then provided the answer to, suggests that we really are getting close on this one. And I think the evidence of compromise that's all over this is another great sign. So just a warning, we may actually be ready to move on this one.
We do need to wait for public comment to close, but before I ask here to respond, let's take another question from the floor.
Right.
Hello. Can you... This rapid suspension procedure slide... To move to the slide, this... A rapid suspension procedure. I have a question to the last item. remedies, yes. What do you mean transfer of domain name after decision is not remedy? This means transfer domain name for the company registrar who registered an infringed domain, or what?
In essence, it's suggesting that this is some sort of interim process. It's not a final process. So that if you actually then wanted an order for transfer, you would have to go ahead with the UDRP process. Uh-huh. This would be a way to take down a site which is causing immediate and ongoing damage, but it's not a way to get hold of a site from somebody else.
It's not clear. For example, if I'm registered at coca-cola.pp, So after some time, I have registration for 1 year. After some time, I just was sued for the infringement of trademark. So I'm honestly paid. It's not my responsibility that registry made this registration. Do I have a right to transfer all my business in this domain, for example, to some other domain for the same, saving the same prices or similar issues?
My understanding, and Mary, I don't know if you want to come in on this, is that if somebody has applied for suspension, the domain has been suspended, and no further action has been taken by the rights holder against you, once the suspension is lifted, you can carry on doing business in that domain. Mary, you want to...
In this case, please change the wording of this, because it's not clear. It's ambiguous.
I think the answer is don't rely on PowerPoint.
Yeah.
You know, power corrupts, but PowerPoint corrupts absolutely. I think the point is to read the SDI proposal and then the staff amendments to that. And the public comment closes, as I said before, on 1 April. Interestingly enough, April Fool's Day in most of the world. Alan, you wanted to respond?
Yeah. One of the problems is we use the word transfer in at least three different ways. We typically use the word transfer for domain names typically means to transfer to a different registrar. That has nothing to do with this here. Our use of the word transfer in the STI and I think the IRT says, can the complainant take custody of the domain name after the dispute? In a UDRP, they can. We said in the URS, they cannot, which is what that was saying. And I think what the gentleman was asking is, can he transfer the website, as it were, to a new domain he registers, which wasn't subject to a complaint? And the answer is he can do whatever he wants with his website and a new domain name.
Thank you. Since I am a member of the BCA, just I want to voice some of their concerns, although I don't represent them here on this panel, which I agree with. The remedies, some of the minority positions taken by the BC and some of the problems, and I want to speak to this because Peter mentioned that maybe the silence meant that everything was fine on this one and it'll go through. I just wanted to sort of, you know, caution that on certain, just a few points. I want to say, though, that there was a high level of consensus amongst everybody in this, but there were certain minority aspects, and I'd just like to highlight them. The first point I'd like to mention is that this is the only post-launch remedy for second level. It's very important to have that context. There are no other second-level remedies for defensive registration issues, number one. Number two, the remedy, the only remedy allowed under the URS to a successful complainant is that the domain name gets suspended, and after a year he can pay extra money and allow the suspension to move on for one extra year. Now, what happens at the end of the second year, basically, or the year and a half or whatever it may be, the domain name goes back into the pool. So to some people, it was like a game of whack-a-mole at the end of that 1.5 years. And okay, whack this down again. Let's get it. File another URS. File another URS after a certain period. And at some point, there'll be a pipeline of these that brand owners may have to deal with. So some degree of concern was demonstrated. It's part of the minority report that says that transfer or some other, even the IPC agrees that you should be able to purchase that domain name on a priority basis. Maybe that's the remedy after the suspension. Not a free transfer, but to buy it. Fine. The other aspect of the BCA report was that the cost of this wasn't, to some, looking as if this is going to be competitive and be rapid, because, you know, it's a 20-day process. Just 21 is what the UDRP does. It's a 20 days. But it has other benefits. And so I just wanted to caution that those are the aspects. When we say that the URS should go through with maybe these minor slight changes, at least from my perspective or the perspective of the BC, then I think we're pretty much there with a fairly good rights protection mechanism which applies. But it leaves open other areas of defensive registration or rights protection against the issue of defensive registration. And I think those need to be also sort of taken into account. However, I agree this one's pretty much done with maybe these few exceptions.
Thank you. Jeff, I've noted that Christina has a question, but first, Margie has some comments and statements that have come through that she'd like to read.
Actually, I was going to refer to Christina's question. She asks, what if the URS is not faster or cheaper?
Anyone volunteering to take that?
Christina, I'm not sure.
Follow up on the question. Just to give some background information, it's been suggested to some members of the IPC by one UDRP provider that in its current iteration, the URS may not, in fact, be faster or cheaper, which were the two key goals of the URS, of course, in the context of kind of slam dunk facts. So I guess my question to the STI members is, if it's really not faster or cheaper in its current iteration, what changes, if any, would you be willing to consider agreeing to, and if none, why not?
Any comment to that? Right, I think everybody is... Kurt is volunteering to pick up the hot stone or the oven gloves.
Well, only briefly. You know, the really short answer is if it's not cheaper or faster, people won't use it. The reason why we think it will be is it wasn't just based on an excellent thought process in the IRT, but rather it was based on real experiences where Nominet, for example, has an expedited procedure, and we could look at real costs. The IRT could look at real costs and real prices from Nominet and other places. So it's based, the URS is based on real experiences, it's certainly not a brand new invention.
The point to be made is that Nominet is one of the few places that actually uses a mediation approach in its expedited process rather than an adversarial approach, which would be wonderful if we could all just get along. But Anthony, I think you had a comment that you wanted to make, and I'm assuming it's largely the same as the one that came through the chat room. Ah, okay. So then let's deal with your colleague's comment that came through.
Jonathan Frakes has a question. Has the panel reviewed this Fortune 100 study on defensive registrations in new TLDs? He indicates that his company did a study on the Fortune 100 companies and a number of brands looking at registration trends for those brands, and they concluded that all source data, and they substantiated their findings, having been reviewed by a third party. The study showed that there was little defensive or squatted registration in available new TLDs for these brands. Any comments from the panelists?
Nobody jumping on that one. Anthony.
Yeah, let me just simply say I have a copy of that if anyone wants to review it. If you haven't reviewed it, obviously you can't respond, but I have a copy. Thank you.
Then maybe we simply note the question. It's certainly something that has seen some interesting discussion so far in corridors and elsewhere. Maybe then we move on to Jeff dealing with the post-delegation rights protection, and then we can take some general queries at the end.
Sure. So for many of you, I'm sure you have not really focused too much on the post-delegation dispute resolution process, but it's something that the registry stakeholder group has focused on considerably and has submitted comments in each of the past comment periods. And not to disappoint Peter, who made the statement that it seemed like the URS was substantially done, I think this one has a good way to go. And I think there are a lot of pretty controversial issues here. For those of you that don't know the post-delegation dispute resolution process, it's essentially a process that was recommended by the IRT and also had some
support initially from the World Intellectual Property Organization, intended to be used against registries that are engaging in systemic trademark infringement at the top or second level. The parties to the dispute, at least as ICANN has proposed, is the trademark owner and the registry itself. There are fees that ICANN has recommended, which actually they haven't recommended the exact fees, but the structure where the fees would be shared between the registries and the trademark holder filing the dispute, but ultimately the loser pays. In other words, the prevailing party will have their fees returned to it. The remedies, one thing that ICANN has clarified is that there are a suggested set of remedies that are graduated tools that ICANN could use in order to implement against a registry that is found to have violated this process. And then ICANN has added a provision that says, absent extraordinary circumstances, ICANN will review, approve, and enforce the recommended remedies, or ICANN also has some discretion to amend that as well. So let me start with the positive changes that we've seen in the last draft, that the panel makes the recommendations to ICANN with respect to the remedies as opposed to ICANN just implementing whatever the panel has decided. The default used to be in the old version where if there was a default against the registry, there would be an immediate finding against the registry and penalties would be implemented. Right now, as it's set in the new proposal, there would still be a review by the panelist of whether the registry violated the policy. And then the third thing that was positive change was that, at least from a registry perspective, was that affirmative conduct is required under all of the grounds for disputes. And I think the World Intellectual Property Organization made a comment earlier today that it disagreed with that new standard of or that new burden. There are I have at least seven major items that I believe more work is needed by ICANN. I believe that ICANN needs to be more involved in the disputes at the outset. As the IRT recommended, it's not enough to state that ICANN will continue to do contractual compliance in the explanatory section, but there really should be an affirmative commitment by ICANN to do this prior to a third party initiating a complaint. And there must be ramifications for ICANN's failure to enforce agreements. ICANN is very good at asking registries and registrars for service-level commitments, and I think the community, it's time for us to demand that ICANN make those same service-level commitments to us. I think also ICANN needs to be more involved in determining the actual remedies as well. So in their proposal, what's said is that ICANN will, or it says, absent extraordinary circumstances, ICANN will implement what the panelist determines. But to rely on one panelist to make a sole determination that of what the remedy should be is really, I believe, an abdication of ICANN's responsibilities under the registry agreement. And really what we're talking about in most of these panelists is, you know, possibly one trademark attorney who may or may not have experience in dealing with these types of adjudications. The third point that I would like to make is that this post-delegation dispute resolution process must not replace contractual dispute resolution mechanisms in the registry agreement. In other words, ICANN must make or must acknowledge specifically that all determinations and remedies recommended by the panelists or even implemented by ICANN shall be entitled to de novo review through the dispute resolution process set forth in the registry agreement. In other words, registries have in their agreement an arbitration provision, and that provision should not be waived simply because there's one panelist that decides against the registry. The fourth thing is that there's still a requirement for registries to pay half of the costs up front. This is an interesting requirement because it's not in any other dispute mechanism that's recommended by ICANN in any other circumstance, nor is it required in most courts around the world. And I believe will be used by overzealous trademark owners to extort a settlement or other undesirable outcome. And so what I'd like to know from someone at ICANN is, what is the compelling justification for requiring a registry to pay fees up front? Because I don't believe I've seen that. Another item, and I do want to kind of move quickly because it would be great to get some comments from everyone else in the community, but there is an ability in the document for a panelist to award monetary damages, to actually award some monetary amount that a panelist finds is the harm of a trademark owner. And from a registry perspective, this has to be removed. Again, this is not in any other type of dispute resolution proceeding that ICANN has ever endorsed. So for those of you not familiar with the determination of damages or financial harm in an ordinary trademark dispute, this can actually be one of the most complex adjudicatory decisions, which usually only arise after you have a lot of discovery, the presentation of evidence, one or more hearings, and they're always subject to cross-examination. But here, surprisingly, we have one panelist, unless for some reason the parties both agree there should be three, which we believe should be changed. There's no hearing, there's no presentation of evidence, there's no cross-examination, and there's a 20-page limit in both the complaint and the response. With all of those things combined, you know, this is something that really, I don't understand how one trademark panelist could decide financial harm and award that against the registry. And the final point that I have is that ICANN has done a really good job at describing in the explanatory notes that this really should not be used for ordinary trademark infringement or actions in which there was no affirmative conduct. But I believe that ICANN needs to provide examples of safe harbors for registries. In other words, there should be specific examples like there are in the UDRP where a registry can allege or can put forth an affirmative defense to respond to these claims against it. Those are my major concerns with policy. And I know that this post-delegation has not been subject to too many consultations, and I do believe that really substantial work is required in this area before we can check the box and consider it done.
Jeff, so what I'm hearing from you is you're of the view at this stage that's not something that you could necessarily live with. It's not something that requires rough edges to be smoothed, but something that requires to be completely reworked.
I'm not sure it needs to be completely reworked, but I think that there are, and I plan on submitting in the comment period a red line of the draft document that ICANN has to make their job a little bit easier. Some of us had offered to sit down with ICANN staff to help them with a red line earlier on, but we're not taking up on that offer. But we'll again extend that offer to help drive this to conclusion. The registries as a whole don't object to a post-delegation dispute resolution process, but it needs to be one that actually has due process and needs to be one where, if you look at some of the comments from ICANN in the analysis, they rejected some of our comments because they said it would slow down the process or wasn't good for expediency's sake. And my question back to ICANN staff is, since when is expediency, in this case, or efficiency, a substitute for just getting it right? We're talking about a registry could lose its entire business based on this one complaint. So, you know, I think efficiency and expediency are not necessarily the highest values that we should be looking at when deciding this issue.
Yeah, I think we have it clear. Jeff, I suppose that view is also notwithstanding your blog post a couple of months ago where you expressed dissatisfaction with the fact that at that stage the post-delegation dispute resolution mechanism had been dropped and you called for its reintroduction.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the comments that I've made today are consistent with those comments, and I do believe that ICANN has made progress in the post-delegation dispute process, and so there were some improvements that were made. I'm trying to get this to move forward. I know the community wants the post-delegation dispute resolution process, and so in trying to make it work for everyone, you know, the registries are willing to sit down and try to come up with a workable procedure.
And Zanit, does the community want a post-delegation dispute resolution process?
I think that it's a good idea in the case of top-level problems. In other words, if the actual top-level domain is found to be infringing or suspected to be infringing. At the second level, I think there's a huge number of problems with it. Personally, I think it's outrageous. As far as I know, abusive behavior is not very well defined. I think it's unbelievable that a single panelist with unknown experience might actually shut down an entire registry and award monetary damages on the basis of a single complaint. I think that's outrageous, and I don't know how it's got this far.
Let's see if there are views on the panel. It starts on the side of the sphere.
I think some of that can be addressed by gradation of different remedies, as usually done in international commercial arbitration, but I wanted to get to another point here. Staff was not sent to look at it. The second solution.
If I could just on difficulty.
I would note that if you